Hello, and welcome to the 2008 Pen World Voices Festival. My name is Dinam Mangestu, and I'm honored and delighted to welcome you all here to this session titled Crisis Darfur. Tonight, our special guests are Mia Farrow and Bernard-Henri Lévy. You will also notice an empty chair sitting on the stage. This chair represents those artists around the world who have been robbed of their right to freedom of expression, who are prevented from practicing their craft openly or without fear of persecution, and who are unable to join us today. It is a reminder that the silencing of writers in one country robs the entire world of their voices. This particular chair is dedicated to one of our colleagues currently in prison in China. This year, Pen American Center is conducting an international campaign to win the release of more than 36 writers and journalists in Chinese prisons before the Olympic Games open in Beijing in roughly 100 days. At this event, we remember Shen Shuxing, dissident writer and leading member of the Jiang branch of the banned China Democratic Party, arrested on September 14, 2006, and charged with inciting subversion. Chen's case was twice handed back to the police for lack of evidence, but on August 14, 2007, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison and 1 year's deprivation of political rights. His appeal was rejected without a hearing by the Jiang High People's Court on October 29, 2007. Chen is being held at Jiaozhou Prison in Hangzhou City, Jiang Province. Please join Pen's efforts to win the release of Shen Shuxing and all the writers and journalists currently in prison in China. Sign the petition at the Pen table outside of the festival and join Pen as a member to support all of our programs. You can also sign the petition and join Pen online at www.pen.org. The title of this conversation is called Crisis Darfur, and I can't quite think of any better term to describe what's going on in Darfur, and maybe the word crisis doesn't quite encapsulate the complexity of this evening and the complexity of the situation inside of Sudan. The war, since its inception in 2003, has grown only more complicated. Darfur rebel groups have splintered and turned against each other. The neighboring countries of Chad and Central African Republic have become inextricably entwined with their own refugee crises and their own internally displaced populations. For those of us witnessing the tragedy of Darfur, we're faced with our own moral and political crisis. How do we respond to what's been called the first genocide of the 21st century? How do we mobilize and enact a moral and political outrage? And how do we best aid the citizens of Darfur in their search for a normal and peaceful life? Tonight, our first speaker is Bernard-Henri Lévy. Mr. Lévy is a French philosopher and author of more than 30 books. American Vertigo, Traveling America in the Footsteps of Tocqueville was a New York Times bestseller, and his new book, Left in Dark Times, will be published this fall. Lévy has undertaken several diplomatic missions for the French government. He was appointed by French President Jacques Chirac to head a fact-finding mission to Afghanistan in 2002 in the wake of the war against the Taliban, a war that Lévy supported. He has traveled to the world's most troubled areas and followed the trail of Daniel Pearl in Pakistan to research who killed Daniel Pearl. His book, War, Evil, and the End of History, took him to the world's forgotten wars, from Colombia to Sri Lanka, and his reportage and commentary from Israel during the 2006 Lebanon War appeared to wide acclaim in the New York Times Magazine. After an extensive clandestine visit to Darfur in 2007, he reported on the ethnic cleansing and genocide there for Le Monde and in the United States for the New Republic. I present Mr. Bernard-Henri Lévy.
I was there, as Dinam Mengistu said, just 1 year ago, nearly day for day, 1 year ago, smuggling myself through the border with Chad, crossing 500, 600 kilometers inside the devastated Darfur. And I must say that what I saw then, what I experienced there, never left my mind and my heart still then. I was deeply shocked in the most intense sense of the word by this experience, even if I lived many others in my life since my youth in Bangladesh till Pakistan. What I saw in Darfur, in a way, bypassed, overwhelmed a lot of things which I experienced before. So to speak about that again, 1 year after, is really for me a real emotion. I want to say, by the way, thank you to the Pen Club to have decided to open, to devote this opening of the festival to this event with Mia Farrow about Darfur, to have put this festival of the Pen Club under the behalf, under the sign of Darfur, is something of which I am so grateful to all the people of Pen Club, Michael Roberts, and everybody. Thanks to them. I would like to tell you an introduction before the discussion with Mia and discussion with you. I would like to sum up in a few remarks what I saw and what I concluded during this journey which I made in this very ill-informed area. We have very few informations from this area where I were, with a photograph of the French agency Gamma. I would like to sum up the conclusion I did draw from this journey. My first conclusion was, and still is, that we should stop speaking of the crisis of Darfur or even the war in Darfur. It is not a crisis, it is not a war. A war supposes, of course, a front line, supposes organized battles, and supposes even more, two real armies. It is not a war between two armies. It is a war by an army against civilian populations. It is not a civil war. It is a war against the civilians. Of course, you have in Darfur and in the areas I visited some guerrillas. I could enter inside, I could smuggle myself, thanks to them. But they are so poorly equipped, they are so poorly weaponed, armed, that it cannot be called an army. Not at all. I saw one battalion, for example, composed of 200 men, young men, not children, young men. They had five mortars. They had three launchers of rockets, very few weapons. They had some cars, which they took from the army in front. These cars had so little fuel to go, that when they tried to go to a battle, when, like in Jemel Mara a few days before my arrival, they tried to repel an assault, they had to push the cars by hands of men till the front line, because of shortage of fuel. I saw also these guerrillas trying to protect as they can what is remaining of the population of Darfur. I saw, and I have an image of that, I don't know where it is, maybe here, yes. This guy in the front of the photo, who has one of these machine guns, and he has around the neck a big, impressive, I don't know how you call that, a sort of cartouchier, we say in French. When I went to see closer to him what was in the cartouchier, what was in this thing he has around the neck, one out of four holes was full with a bullet. Three out of four were empty and filled with little papers as this one, which were verses of Quran. And they replaced the bullet. So please, not a war, not a civil war. A war against civilians, whom these sorts of guys try to protect with their little, poor equipment. My second conclusion, which I drew from this journey, is that we should get rid, at least for a part, of the myth of the Janjaweed. There is a lot of big stories about the Janjaweed, these horsemen of the devil, ill-equipped themselves, arriving in the villages, burning the huts, spreading the fear, like in the Middle Ages. What I saw is not exactly that. I saw some huge holes in the ground, some craters of bombs, which were the result of a bombing from not a horseman, but a plane, an Antonov, which overflew the area a few days before my arrival. This is not Janjaweed. This is a real bombing plane. What everybody told me is that these Janjaweed, when they arrive, generally in lorries, in trucks, they are commanded by some people in uniforms and or half uniforms who happen to belong to the Sudanese army. I saw also, this is something else, this is the remnants, the vestige of a little house which was destroyed a few days before my arrival. I saw one lorry, which is a Sudanese-built lorry in a factory near Khartoum with some French and Chinese capital money. So, Janjaweed, Cavalier du Diable, Horseman of the Apocalypse, and so on, all this folklore, maybe. But also a real war, with real weapon, with real violence, not low intensity violence, hard intensity violence, equipped, directed by the army of a state, which is a state of Sudan. I saw that. I bear testimony of that. Does what happened in Darfur deserve, if I dare say, the name of genocide or not? Genocide. I know that there is a polemic on this point. Some say that it is a genocide, others say that it is not quite a genocide. There is a sort of discussion similar to the discussion about the sex of the angels in the medieval, in the Middle Ages times. What I saw, what I bear testimony of, what I witnessed, what you can see in this photo, what you can see in this one, what you can see in this one, what you can see in this one, makes this sort of discussion completely absurd and frivolous. First of all, as you know, the decision of a genocide, the planified decision to exterminate, to eradicate a people, is never known in real times, is never announced in CBS News or in AFP. The conference of Wannsee where was decided the final solution against the Jews was known long after, as you know. So I will not enter in that. What I must say, what I want to say today in this opening session of the Penn Festival is that I traveled 500 or 600 kilometers in one sense, 5 in the other one, in an area rather big where I hardly found trace of human life. Sometimes where I did not even find trace of human death. Even the dead had been volatilized. Even the traces of these villages, which you see here, in many places, had been erased. A sort of burnt earth. A politic of burnt earth in a huge dimension, which I frankly never saw to this extent. I was in Burundi, I was in Rwanda, I was in Angola, in the worst areas of the war between the MPLA and the Savimbi groups. I was in South Sudan 7 years ago with John Garang, whom I interviewed for Le Monde and New Republic, I think, too. I went in the Nuba Mountains in the center of South Sudan. There, too, I saw some mass murders. But this extent, this burnt earth, this complete devastation, this will to eradicate even the trace of human life, I must confess that I did not often see it, and maybe never. Another thing which I never saw to this extent, and which makes to my eyes completely outrageous and frivolous the polemic about genocide or not, is the very point, as you know, which is the impossibility to give the real number of the dead. Nobody knows if it is 200,000 dead, the number which is given on and on since years, if it is, which is my evaluation, closer to 300 or 350. Some say, some human rights organization, serious one, say 400, maybe 500,000. From 200 to 500,000, nobody being able to decide which is the right figure, which means that there might be in Darfur hundreds of thousands of children, women, men, raped, killed, burned, without any memory, without any inscription anywhere, without grave, without face, without name, without number. This impossibility of the number, this evidence of huge mass murders, the victims of which had not even the poor, I would not say consolation, of course, or solace, but could not have even this poor little thing to have a place to rest and a place in the memory of the survivors. This, in the age of today, is not so frequent. Is not so frequent. These huge mass murders, impossible to calculate. These hundreds of minuscule lives, tiny lives, not even worth of remembrance, or whom their murderers made not even worth of remembrance. There is a very famous American book of James Agee. I know the title in French, in American, The original title is Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. I would like tonight, and I try without stopping since 1 year, to try to praise, if I can, infamous men. Men without fame, men without name, murdered people without any trace in the memory of mankind. This is Darfur of today. I don't know if it is genocide or not, but it is a situation which is incomparable to most of the killings which take place and which are also horrible, of course, in other places of the world. You have some places where you have some killings, you have some funerals, you have the possibility to cry, you have the possibility to number. Here it is the reverse. The question now is to know why. My nearly last remark. Why? Why that? And why is the international community so passive since more than 4 years now in front of this situation? Why this passivity? Why this inability to take decisions, or when they are taken, to make them respected? Of course, there are some obvious reasons. The regime of Khartoum, the regime of the murderers, has some oil. And to have some oil today gives you, in the modern world, in the world of today, gives you, at least for a time, some rights which you don't have if you don't have oil. You have also the reason, which is true, that the Khartoum regime managed to make the Western countries, and especially America, believe that they had a card to play, they, Khartoum, in the war against terrorism. As you know, Osama bin Laden lived in Khartoum before September 11th, during a few years, and has left a real documented part of his life there. And the regime of Khartoum built, I don't know to which extent it is true, maybe it is true that they have some informations. I doubt a little, but this is probably another reason. But the main reason of our indifference, of our impossibility to number this outnumbered dead, the real and deepest reason of our despair, Mia, myself, others, when we try to be a witness of all that, is not an economical one, is an ideological one. In a few words, and maybe we will discuss that more deeply in the conversation later. We are here in front of a sort of perverse effect of three great modern ideas, a sort of paradoxical and counter effect of three great ideas, which are anti-racism, anti-colonialism, and fight against imperialism. Three great ideas, among the best which have been produced in the 20th century. In this case, by a sort of ruse of the history, they produce a very strange effect. Anti-racism. You have a huge part of the population, of the public opinion in America and in Europe, who believe, as a sort of Pavlovian reflex, that these sort of murders, these sort of genocides, cannot be committed by ugly, stupid white men, as we did, white men in Auschwitz, in Gulag, and so on, which is undoubtedly true. There is the idea that such mass murders committed by people who were themselves victims of racism during such a long time is a sort of contradiction in the terms. Anti-colonialism. We have been bred in the idea, in the conviction that colonialism, and it is true, is a horror, is a crime, is something we have to get rid of. Intervention in the affairs of a country of the third world is something we have to avoid absolutely because it produced such ill effects in the past, colonialism. And this is true, it produces the idea that when a country of the third world, which has been colonized as Sudan has been, commits such bloodbath, commits such crimes, to stop his arm, to try to prevent him, to intervene in order to make him stop, could be an act of colonialism. And you have in America and in France a lot of people in the left camp, to which I belong, who say, we cannot interfere in the internal affairs of Sudan. Let's be careful not to impose under the flag of human rights the old rule of the Western superiority. The result of that is that we are abandoning to the worst death unnumbered lots of people. And at the end, anti-racism, anti-colonialism, and anti-imperialism. We are prisoners of a scheme of thought in which if you are a victim and if you don't play a role, if you don't have a part on the big stage, in the big history, in the big tale of the opposition of the evil empire and the good anti-imperialist forces, you don't really deserve attention. In the past decades already, in the 60s, 70s, at the time of the Cold War, if you were neither with the Soviets nor with the US, you had pretty good chance to fall in the big hole of the ignored wars. Today, if you have not a real role in this big fight, which is supposed to be the fight of the poor against the empire, you don't exist. These poor people, these women, the son of whom will die in a few hours, has nothing to do with a big story, which is a story of Mr. Chomsky, the story of Mr. Badiou in France, story of people in England, which is the story of the fight against empire. Nothing to do with this fight, so out of frame, out of our visibility, non-existing person. So we see in Sudan we face a sort of terrible counter-effect of these three great ideas, which remain great, but which have to be corrected by other principles, other values, the idea, for example, that a dead man has no color, that you have not privileged victims, or privileged murderers and suspect victims and so on, has to be corrected by that. And to end, what can we do in front of that? In front of this devastation, in front of this incomparable mass murder? First of all, of course, to try to make it visible as Mia Farrow tries to do much more than myself since the beginning, going there again and again, bearing some testimony, as she will do in 1 minute again. First of all, to make it visible, to force this wall of invisibility, which is the wall of the big story, of the big tale of today. Number two, we can and we should, and it is possible to ask for real sanctions to the state of Sudan, despite the oil. What we do with Uzbekistan, what we do with Zimbabwe, what we did with Sudan at the end, after 20 years of the war against the South, and which worked, which is some sanctions on the persons, some interdictions of traveling, the freezing of the money they have in non-secret, not-so-secret accounts in some of our banks. This can be done. Real sanction on the guilty people, the name of whom are perfectly well known. And last but not least, we can. There is one weapon which we plead for, Mia Farrow in America and myself in Europe, since months and months. There is one actor of this terrible game who has a huge power, who can do a lot if he wants. This actor is China. China is the one who provides the weapon which I saw and which did these big crater of bombs. China provides the weapon. China buys big part of the oil. China protects the Sudanese regime in the Security Council of the United Nations. So the real pressure, the most efficient one, should be and is still today the pressure on China. And we have a tool, as you know, on China. We have a real weapon which would prove to be really efficient if we tried. It has been tried since a few days about Tibet. It already gives a few results. The resuming of the dialogue with Dalai Lama, it should be implemented in the Darfur tragedy. It is the arm, the weapon of the boycott of the Olympic Games. We cannot accept the very idea of Olympic Games, Olympic ideal, supposed to be a peace ideal, in a country which is guilty of that, which is guilty of this disaster, which is guilty of these areas of villages where you have only the beasts left and the few people who are left being treated themselves as cattle. If we accept to go to Beijing for the games, it will be like in Berlin in 1936, the games of the blood and of the shame. On the contrary, if we really, us, European and America, old and new, and the new Europe, if we join our forces in order to say to Beijing, stop the bloodbath, stop the murder, order your servant of Khartoum regime to stop the bloodbath, they can, they will, and then the Olympic Games will be able to take place. Sanctions on the persons, visibility of this horror, threat of boycott of Olympic Games, plus a last idea, which we will present to you at the end of the evening, Mia and Me, which will be, I let you discover it at the end. All this should prevent us from saying that we are impotent, unable, that there is nothing to do. There is a lot to do to save what is still savable of Darfur. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Levy. Our next speaker this evening is Mia Farrow, who doesn't probably actually need that much of an introduction. She has become one of our greatest advocates for human rights and is also one of our greatest and most well-known actresses. Mia Farrow has appeared in more than 40 films and won numerous awards. In 1997, she published her memoir, What Falls Away. Ms. Farrow is also a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador and has worked extensively to draw attention to the plight of children. Ms. Farrow has traveled to Darfur 8 times to advocate for an end to the crisis there and has published multiple op-eds about the genocide in the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times. Her website, miafarrow.org, focuses on the Darfur crisis. Ms. Mia Farrow.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Guernica. Thank you to Penn. Thank you, Bernard-Henri Lévy, for sharing what you have witnessed. It is impossible not to be shaken by what we hear from you. I have recently returned from my 8th journey into the Darfur region of Sudan. Incomprehensibly, more than 5 years have passed since the government of Sudan and its proxy killers, the Janjaweed, launched their campaign of destruction upon the non-Arab populations of Darfur. Only the perpetrators dispute that hundreds of thousands of innocent men, women, and children have been slaughtered. It is all the more appalling, as you have said, that we cannot count the dead. The UN figure hovered at 200,000 for 2 or 3 years, no one died in Darfur. And suddenly people are saying, probably 500,000. Many, many people, Eric Reeves, Sudan expert, has said it's in excess of 500,000. But we don't know. And the travesty and disrespect of that is beyond comprehension, but also in keeping of what we know about Darfur. One of the first image that was preceded this said, never again. Never again. After the Nazi Holocaust, the world vowed never again. How obscenely disingenuous those fine words sound today. We see Sudan. It is the largest country in Africa. The Darfur region, as you see in the western part of Sudan, the darkened area, note the borders with Chad and the Central African Republic, because they are completely porous or non-existent. Villages literally straddle the borders. And eastern Chad is an inferno, as is the northeast corner of Central African Republic. I wanted, many people ask why, and I was just going to fill in a little bit so that we don't have to cover that later. Oil was found in the south part of Sudan many years ago. There was a war that waged for 2 decades, as Mr. Levy said, in which some 2 million people died. The West intervened and sponsored eventually the North-South Agreement, which was signed in 2005. Oil revenues were to be shared, and Southerners were to have significant representation in the government, Khartoum-based government. But the Darfur region was left out of that agreement, left essentially in the dark ages where the British had left it when they attached it to Sudan. They left in 1956, they left, and they left governance to an Arab government in Khartoum. They favored the Arabs. The people in the Darfur region are non-Arab. So in 2003, there was some young men formed a rebel group, and there was an uprising in the center of the Darfur region. They incinerated a couple of planes. They killed some government soldiers. And in response to this uprising, the government of Sudan launched an all-out assault upon the civilian population of Darfur. The justification for attacking civilians in this manner was that civilians were the base of the rebel movement. People of Darfur, they wanted hospitals, they wanted compensation, they wanted representation in the government, they wanted schools, they wanted electricity, they wanted to be included. Of course there was an uprising, but the slaughter that followed is what has brought the word Darfur now is synonymous with suffering. I took these pictures over my 8 trips into the region. What you see here is a typical village in Darfur in the year 2004. You see mature fruit trees, walled gardens, there would be animals, and despite the arid soil, people have sustained themselves through the centuries through agriculture. It is an agricultural community. Same village, 2006. 80 to 90% of Darfur's villages are ashes today. The ashes of the village of Tamanjur. The village that you saw first really is notable for the fact that it existed. No longer. I met Mr. Joseph Omar going through these still smoldering ashes of his village, searching to find anything that could be of use to those members of his family that survived the attack. There was a tiny group of people huddled a few kilometers away, dazed, terrified, surrounded by their attackers, not knowing which way to turn, without food, without water. Mr. Omar returned at great peril to himself to try to salvage something, but really, he found almost nothing, a pot and a lid. The food was gone. The village was gone. Children had been thrown into burning huts. People had been mutilated. Women had been raped. 2.5 million people have been driven from villages such as you saw the first picture of into camps such as this. This is Kalma Camp in West Darfur. I took this in 2004 from a helicopter, and it was my first sighting of an internally displaced person's camp. If a person is in their own land, they're not a refugee. The technical term is internally displaced person. They are displaced people, and what you're seeing here is sheeting lashed to the desert floor. Not a tree, nor a blade of grass, nor scarcely a shred of hope. The lack of trees is significant because where the camps are, there are no trees, and whatever shrubbery had existed would have been used to build fires. The World Food Program distributes sorghum. Sorghum requires more than 2 hours cooking on an open fire. An open fire requires wood. As you can see from this camp of 90,000 people, there was no wood. This means that the women and the population of the camps are primarily women and children. They have to leave the relative safety of the camp, and I say relative because the camps themselves are continually attacked. The camps are cauldrons of despair and rage. And people have to leave to get the firewood. And as of 2006, June, when I encountered a UN assessment team, the average deforestation around a camp was 10 miles, obviously considerably further today, meaning a woman had to travel in excess of 10 miles, being exposed for 20 miles to attacks, mutilations, abductions, rapes by what Mr. Levy has told you, John Jaweed, literal translation, evil or devils on horseback. They encircle the camps and they pick off women who leave the camps. I couldn't capture the size of this camp. It is the largest camp in the world. It's Gereda, population 175,000. It is near Niala, and because of the attacks on aid workers, there were only 7 aid workers, no doctor, no medical personnel, addressing the needs of 175,000 human beings. The getting of the firewood. I took this in 2004 when you would see donkeys in Darfur. It is the Sophie's choice of who will get the firewood today. In this case, an older woman chose to spare her daughters the danger and horrors. And in an Islamic culture, in a Muslim culture, where rape, the victims of rape are held culpable, where as a horrific rape is to us in Western culture, it is 1,000 times worse for a Muslim woman. Behind the woman, you can see, it looks like an airplane, but actually it was an attack helicopter crossing the skies of Darfur, going about the grim business of bombing the villages. Getting the firewood. I have to say, more often than not, I could not bring my camera to my eyes to take the photographs. My sisters in Darfur showed me their mutilations, the brandings they suffered when they were raped, the tendons sliced in their legs so that the mark of rape, how they had to hobble now when they went to get the firewood, breasts burned. I felt then two things. One is I should not be taking this picture. And the overriding one is I am a witness to these atrocities, and it should not be easy to turn away. And the women wanted, they asked me to tell our sisters in my country what is happening to them. I have around my neck, actually, it is called a hijab. It contains a piece of the Quran. A woman named Halima gave it to me in 2004. She insisted that I have it for my protection. I, who could offer her no protection? She had been wearing it on the day her village was attacked, and she had been holding her infant son, who was torn from her arms and bayoneted before her eyes. 3 of her 5 children were similarly killed on that day, and her husband too. John Jaweed, she said, they cut them and threw them into the well. And then she clasped my hands and said, tell people what is happening here. Tell them we will all be slaughtered. And if my moral mandate wasn't clear by that moment, it certainly was clarified from that time on. And unfortunately, Halima's story is identical to the stories of countless women that I have met in my journeys into the region. The stories of, and this woman, when she was raped by, she said 20 to 30 men raped her, and they put fire sticks, she said, out on her body as they raped her. And also they called her the worst kind of racial slurs, and now you will give birth to a light-skinned child. The camps. The camps, after 5 years, you can see the sheeting handed out in 2004 has disintegrated. People are now using their last line of defense, which is their blankets. The relentless sun, the rainy season, the sandstorms has ripped the sheeting to nothing. It's disintegrated, and people shelter there under the blankets. But I have to say, I mean, the camps are so unsafe that humanitarian work is grinding to a halt. Last December, the Oxfam, the head of Oxfam in Sudan said, I read this, our staff are being targeted on a daily basis. They are being shot, robbed, beaten, and abducted. The security situation is the worst since the conflict began. These are not conditions we can keep working in. Attacks on aid workers rose 150% in the last year. The region has become so dangerous that an unprecedented 2 million people are now out of reach of humanitarian access. We don't know where they are. We don't know how they are. UNICEF reports that in many or most of the camps, 30 to 50% of the population is suffering from acute malnutrition. Acute malnutrition. This is what acute malnutrition looks like, in case you haven't seen it. Acute malnutrition. And in the face of acute malnutrition, last week the World Food Program announced that it had cut its food rations into Darfur by half because it is too insecure to deliver by the roads and the airdrops are unsustainably expensive. So what little people were getting has now been halved. Soraya Adam, my friend, and I see her whenever I go to the region. She is 27 years old, and I think in her face is all of Darfur. She walked for 22 days to reach a camp on the borderland in eastern Chad. But when the village was attacked, first by bombs, then by Janjaweed, she gathered her children and tried to run. And she never saw her husband again, and two of the children died on the long walk. She said she ran, and someone said there was a country called Chad, and she didn't know where it was. And she kept asking people, do you know of a country called Chad? And she eventually ended up in a camp. But two of the children, and she told me the agony of not being able to bury the children, that she could only scratch the sand to cover her children with some sand and had to move on because the children were dying. The attacks on villages are, the accounts of those who survived the attacks are numbingly similar. Without warning, always the morning skies fill with bombers and attack helicopters, raining bombs upon homes and families as they sleep, as they pray, as they prepare breakfast, as they are going out to the fields. Here you see children's drawings that the children gave them to me in these what are called child-friendly spaces in the camps. Children are allowed to draw whatever they want, and so often they draw the day that changed their lives. And they gave me these pictures, and I've given them to the Holocaust Memorial in Washington, but I share some of them with you because they depict very vividly what happened to them. The houses were on fire, the bomb ships dropping bombs. This child drew her mother cooking breakfast and the man, the Janjaweed, with a machine gun shooting her. And she, the child, running. People running, being shot as they run. Women, children, without discrimination. People shot. People raped. This helicopter is dropping bombs on this child's pregnant mother. You can see the fetus inside her. This is a very complex picture. In the lower left-hand corner is a picture of a rape. The people of Darfur have been, and they continue to be, slaughtered. Yes, but they are also dying now of disease and of hunger. In the camps, women die of humiliation and shame. They die of despair that they will never be able to return to their homes. They despair because their losses are too numerous to count or ever reclaim. They despair because 5 years of terror is too long. And here you see people begging for mercy, people trying to gather their children, people hiding unimaginable terror. And this woman showed me the bullet wound in her back. She had been running for her life with her child tied to her back, and she was shot in the back. and the bullet passed through the baby, killing him. But the wound, she said, the wound in her heart is the wound that causes her to weep every day, the loss of her child. This group of children was running across the sand, and I happened to encounter them in a week in November in Chad, a year ago last November, when 60 villages were attacked. Arab militia, Janjaweed, crossed over the border into Chad and attacked the non-Arab villages in Chad. Countless thousands of people were killed, and behind these screaming children was their burning village. Here you see people who gathered what they could. If there was any warning, they carried what they could on their backs, and they were just, they didn't know which way to turn or where to go. They didn't know where a camp was. Groups under trees with little to nothing and surrounded by their attackers. This group, you see, doesn't even have mats to sit on, and as you can see, primarily women and children. These attacks in Chad were identical to what we saw in 2004 and 2003 in Darfur. We knew it would cross over into Chad, yet we did nothing. And now Chadian villages are ablaze. Chadians are displaced. And those Darfurians who fled into Chad, 250,000 of them, they too are not safe. This is a woman, her three children were thrown into her own burning home. She was empty of tears, sitting under a tree, beyond grief. And an older woman taking care of younger children, a very familiar sight. They were not her children. She didn't know, but she said she would take care of them. Grief. This was an older woman sitting under a tree. Her village was burned, her loved ones were killed, and she was weeping. And I could offer her no comfort. I held her in my arms. Janjaweed. Very dangerous players in a very dangerous terrain. Janjaweed leaving an attack upon a village. In the tiny border town of Gazbeda, three men lay side by side, their eyes cut out by Janjaweed knives. The tiny medical clinic, there was one doctor trying to address, trying to meet the needs of perhaps 1,000 people pouring out of the 7-room clinic onto the sand. Three men. And this child was shot in the chest. He had stood to defend his village with his bow and arrow, which was no match for machine guns. He died when I came back at nightfall. I was happy that he had died because there was no pain medication for this child. He was 13 years old, and he was in agony. The children. I think the children speak more eloquently than I possibly could. No food 9 days, said this boy. At the end of the day, I had filled my empty water bottle with what the children were sucking from the mud, from the swamp water. That was the water they were drinking, and that was my clean bottle of water. This child is one of many child-headed households in the camps. Their parents were killed, and she is now, she said, the mother of her little sister, and she was defiant in saying that no further harm would come to her little sister. But the baby has not uttered a single sound since the day their village was attacked. It is a traumatized population. This little girl, her parents were killed the day before. A dying child. Child of hope. Actually, this child is my screensaver on my laptop. My personal family, we are for the most part not related by blood, but by something much more important, by love and the deepest kind of commitment. And I tell my children that we are a human family, and When one of us is suffering, we all suffer. And when we turn away, we are surely diminished in the most essential ways. And this is our child, deserving of protection. And in truth, I don't know if she's still alive. And this, I took this in 2004, even above the desperate need for water and for food, the plea for protection from across Darfur and Eastern Chad, from every camp and village. This is what reverberates in my soul. I don't think there can be a more visceral plea from the human heart than protect us. What message, after 5 years, what message have we sent to the people of Darfur? These are the victims of our indifference. The only message we have sent is that they are completely dispensable. There is some larger game of monopoly, and the people of Darfur clearly are simply expendable chips. Next month, I will return to the region. People will again tell me their stories. Again, I will write down every word. I will take more pictures. I will hold broken women in my arms. And again, I will promise them that I will indeed tell the world what is happening to them. And then somehow I will leave them there in that hell, and I will come back to a largely indifferent world. What is needed now and for future genocides, I don't flinch at the word, is the will of the international community to accept its responsibility to protect those civilians imperiled by genocide, ethnic cleansing, whatever you want to call it, mass atrocities. The UN has called it atrocities of the worst kind, a responsibility unanimously accepted by the United Nations in 2005, but words proving to be as hollow as never again. And I cannot conclude without mentioning China. As Bernard-Henri Lévy has mentioned, genocide Sudanese style is expensive. It requires the purchase of bombers, attack helicopters, and a steady flow of arms and ammunition. Some 70% of Chinese oil revenues, which now top $4 billion a year, are used to attack the non-Arab population, the civilian population of Darfur. And the vast majority of weaponry used to attack civilians is of Chinese origin. But there is one thing that China holds more dear than its unfettered access to Sudanese oil at this moment in time. That is their successful staging of the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games. And this has provided us with a window of opportunity to weigh in. Under intense international pressure, Beijing hired two international press firms to sanitize their image, and for the first time significantly, they did appoint an envoy to Darfur, and they did sign on to the new UN resolution last July to provide 26,000 peacekeepers to the region. But a scant 9,000 have deployed, and they are placing every conceivable obstacle in the path of an effective deployment of that force. For 5 years, our governments have watched the slaughter in Darfur, and they have failed to take action. And so an unprecedented phenomenon is emerging. Individuals are taking up the responsibility to protect. We see scores of U.S. congressmen, European parliamentarians, Nobel Prize winners, philosophers, intellectuals, sports figures, artists, students, ordinary people, all of them stepping up to protect this agonized population of Darfur, and to urge each of our governments and China to reassess its no-strings-attached support of abusive regimes, not only in Darfur, but around the globe. What can we do? Urge our government to boycott the opening ceremonies of those Olympic Games. I don't know how you feel right now. I don't care what President Bush does next year, but this year he is representing the American people. And if you feel that you don't want him at the opening propaganda, do call the White House. There is a 1-800 genocide number that we've set up. I'm a representative of Genocide Intervention Network, and they'll put you right into the White House. As we've talked about sanctions, make sure your own money isn't in any company such as Fidelity, which is actually invested in PetroChina, which is supporting the genocide in Darfur. So make sure you have a clean account. If you go to my website under What We Can Do, it will give you a website number so you can check where your holdings are. I think most people don't want their own money killing innocent people. Bottom line is, if Beijing elected to act, our country and Europe, nations of the world, we have very little leverage over the government of Sudan. China has immense leverage through its business relationship with Sudan. So if Beijing elected to act rather than talk, it could use its influence to demand that the regime call a halt to the ongoing aerial bombardments and ground attacks of civilians. And China could demand that Khartoum cease to obstruct the peacekeepers. China could refuse to sell weapons to Sudan. How can China host the Olympic Games at home while underwriting genocide in Sudan? The two, I say, are obscenely incongruous. We look at Rwanda and we despair at our own inaction. When the history of this terrible episode in human destruction is finally written, will we have any less reason to despair? Our country, the United Nations, all the nations of the world failed the people of Rwanda, as we are failing the people of Darfur, and we are failing our most essential selves. Elie Wiesel wrote, and I will end on this note, "The victims of the Holocaust perished not only because of the killers, but also because of the apathy of the bystanders. What astonished us after the torment, after the tempest, was not that so many killers killed so many victims, but that so few cared about us at all." I say it is a defining moment for each of us as human beings, where we come down on this. If we don't act now, when and under what circumstances will we act? Thank you very much.
Obviously, both of you concluded your presentations with statements on China, which is clearly sort of an important player in this conflict. But I'd also like to ask you both, given that we've recognized that the Sudanese government has proven its ability to commit genocide, both prior to Darfur in the North-South Agreement, or between the Northern and Southern Sudan, and that did not require any use or any need for China, and it was still able to promulgate a genocide for about 20 years, causing the death of 2 million people. Why exactly do you think now that simply removing China from the equation would be enough to keep the Sudanese government from clearly defying the international will and continuing its slaughter of the Darfur people?
It's a question of leverage, that a lot of money has come into Sudan through China. My first visit to Khartoum, it was like a city on power outages, rubbled streets. The hotel was a shambles with rats and so forth. And then when I returned in 2006, that same Hilton Hotel in Khartoum was chandeliers and wrapped soap and, you know, swanky people milling around in the lobby. And there were it looked like Dubai, big buildings lit pink and blue. What I'm trying to say is, and not that I begrudge anybody wealth coming in, but it's not being distributed. It's being kept in Khartoum and enjoyed by very, very few. They would listen to China in ways that they would not and have not listened to the rest of us if China weighed in a closed room. And I'm not expecting China would ever do this publicly, but come on in this back room for a minute. If you want to continue our relationship, we're looking bad. you know, China could find the words to say, stop the bombing, let the peacekeepers in, do that. That's low-hanging fruit for China to do. And I believe that for sure China has the leverage to do that. You're saying how the financial part, how could they not continue? They have a very strong air force.
Or that they've continued it before regardless, even in the absence of wealth from oil that's being supported by China. The Sudanese government has clearly demonstrated this ability before in the past, and what's going to necessarily change the will right now? Obviously, China does have leverage, but given the government has done this before, they've done it historically, why is the absence of China going
imagine
to make a difference?
Imagine the threat of suspending oil deals. Imagine an international threat of China. If China wouldn't do it, but it could threaten to. China could threaten to hundreds of all of the purchase of the airplanes and everything comes with Chinese money, but the airplanes are coming from China and from Russia, but primarily from China, 90% from China. So I mean, China has all the leverage. China can say what the next 2 years looks like. There's no question about it. China is the only one that has any leverage over Khartoum at this point. It is a rabid regime. Its humanity withered by, as you pointed out, years of genocidal, of killing. The same people who killed in the south. Yes, but now China has considerable influence. What do you say to that?
Yes, I would reverse the terms of your question, my dear Dina. Why did the war against the South last 20 years? Why has the population of the Nuba Mountains nearly been exterminated without any notice, without nearly any information? I was in the Nuba Mountains 7 years ago. I saw some people who did not see any witness, any foreign witness since decades. So why did it last so long? Because there was no leverage. Because there was no window of opportunity. Because there was no way to act and no way to twist the arm of the Sudanese regime. The Sudanese regime is what it is. They are a regime of butchers, of tyrants. They came out after a coup d'etat. They are not angels, of course. We shall not reason them. We cannot exchange reasonable arguments with them. We have to be stronger than them and more cynical, if I dare say, than them. We have today, in the Darfur case, a leverage. This is a historical chance, if I dare to say, for the survivors of the Darfur, that there is the games. The games is an opportunity to act. If we had had this opportunity during the 20 years of the war of extermination against Nuba and against the South, it would not have lasted 20 years. And now, if we let the game pass, if the games happen normally next summer, then the Darfur war can last 20 years.
Well, then, maybe then to continue that same line of conversation is, if the leverage is used against China to act humanitarian, to act accordingly against the Sudanese regime after the Olympics, then where is Darfur and Sudan left with? As you've just noted, that the Sudanese regime is what it is. Post-conflict situations are oftentimes as deadly as conflict situations.
There is one point today, and this will be the content of our joint statement at the end of the evening. The United Nations took a resolution, decided to deploy, to settle 26,000 blue helmets on the grounds to stop the bloodbath. So the problem now is to use the few weeks which remains before the games to obtain the real deployment of the 26,000 people. I don't say that the Sudanese regime will become a good one after the games. I say that after the games, there will be some battalions of peacekeepers, of intervention army, which will be on the ground. This is the only question. It is not a philosophical question. It is not even a political question. It is a technical question. How to do to obtain the implementation of the UN resolution, which is the 26,000 people. We have a little idea about that, which we will express at the end of the evening. But the Chinese role can be capital in that. The Chinese can be capital. They are the one who, in the Security Council, made obstacle by their refusal or abstention to any hard position of the international community.
Yes.
To ask about the sort of post-conflict situation, as you're pointing out, bringing in 26,000 UN troops into the sort of Darfur region, that's a military force, but it's not necessarily a political solution. After you pull China out of Darfur, assuming you can leverage the Olympic Games against
China
them.
Well, China isn't in Darfur.
Well, the Chinese support of the Sudanese government.
Are you putting the hypothetical that if China weighed in, as we would wish, and persuaded Khartoum to cease the assaults on civilians,
yes.
Then what?
Then what? Exactly, the post-conflict situation.
Then begins the long and agonizing process that we've seen in Rwanda, people trying to heal. It will take a generation or more. People going back to their homelands.
I'm also asking exactly how does the Sudanese government, because they can't go back on their own, something they're going to need a government and an institution that allows them to return to their communities, that allows them to rebuild their lives. What leverage do you have against the Sudanese government?
There has
to
be
that?
A peace process, and this has to be, the international community has to weigh in as they did in the North-South. There were many midwives to the North-South agreement, as you know. This has to happen. For too long, we had a part-time envoy here, U.S. Natsios, and now we have a better one, and I believe he's far more devoted, committed. But if every nation supports a peace process, now I was in the South last month, and Salva Kiir said there are only now two rebel groups. 6 months ago, there were like 22. Two are being recognized, and unfortunately, one is headed by Abdul Wahid, who remains in Paris. But if we could get them to the table and everyone in the neighborhood, and that means Libya and Egypt and Chad and Eritrea and everybody who is in that neighborhood to come in on the peace process and make sure that it, unlike the last one, the DPA, the Darfur Peace Agreement of June of 2006, which only one rebel group signed, and I use the word zealot as a verb. Our guy, zealot, shoved that through. To zealot it through means without regard to consequences, and I was there in Darfur 2 weeks later, and it was apparent even to me, and I'm an actress, that it was a disaster, that the non-signatories had split and were armed and angry, and the one signator had joined the government and John Dewey in committing the same kinds of atrocities. So to prevent that from happening, you have to have everybody weighing in and ensuring that an agreement that is deemed to be just by Darfur's people is implemented. That has to happen. And then in the meantime, those peacekeepers have to stay there to ensure that there is security for the people to return home. That's the good case scenario.
I have often observed, or sometimes observed, that we can much more than we think in such situations. I remember the four horrible years of the Bosnia War. 4 years of continuous bloodbath, mass murders, crimes on huge scale. And I remember François Mitterrand, my president, George Bush, the father, your president, saying, we can nothing. It is impossible to intervene. If we try something, we will have to deploy on the ground hundreds of thousands of soldiers. We will have a huge amount of losses. Are you ready, you American people, you European people, to afford these losses? Are you ready to send your children there to die for the Bosnian? This was what was repeated again and again during 4 years. And I remember we were a few, the same as today for Darfur, saying, please, we implore you, let's at least try. Before saying that we cannot, before saying that it is a huge geopolitical imbroglio, before saying that to involve would be worse than the present situation, let's try. We were shouting, crying, imploring that. And when at last it was tried, thanks to President Clinton and President Chirac, it lasted 1 week. 1 week. No losses in the Western camp. A few days to scatter, to make fled, to make flow away the snipers who killed the innocent children in Sarajevo. I mean by that when you have the political will, when you decide to open the eyes, when you decide to use the leverage you have, then you reverse the situation very soon. And my bet is that if we obtain the 26,000 people really on the ground, if we really apply some economical, political and political sanctions to those who are responsible of these huge crimes against humanity, if, as we do with some Zimbabwe responsible, we forbid them to travel in Europe, in America, under the threat of being arrested, grasped, and put in jail, if we freeze the money of the oil, if we prevent or make pressure on our companies not to invest in the blood of these countries, you will see how fast the situation will reverse, how fast some sort of reason will come back. It is not so hard.
Well, you know, we had a hugely effective divestment campaign here in this country. Many, many states, universities, cities divested in companies that were invested in PetroChina and Sinopec. Now what Sudan is doing is they're switching to the euro.
I know.
So we're now hoping that
Absolutely.
Europe will launch such a divestment campaign.
That's why it is so important that any action which would be tried has to be a joint one between America, Europe, and other countries. Of course, any boycott, it is not true to say boycott don't work. Boycotts do work when it is a joint venture, if I dare say, between the countries which are able to implement it. If the game is different, if one says, good luck for me, he boycotts, I come into the breach, of course it does not work. And we are doing that. That is true. In Europe, you have the divestment campaign, and we take advantage of it to invest. This is terrible. This is the worst situation. This is a subject which our presidents, yours for a few months, and ours for a few years, it's a conversation they should have. I don't know what they talk about when they meet, but they could speak of that, this scissor effect between divestment and investment. Mm-hmm. It should be broken.
We're running a little bit low on time, but I would like to open it up to the floor. The question is, who's carrying out the acts, and one of the rebel leaders switched over to the government and can...
One of the rebel leaders, Minnie Minawi by name, in the Darfur peace agreement of 2006, there was one signator. That was Minnie Minawi, representing really the smallest of the rebel groups. The other two rebel groups did not sign. And so they split, and there was one significant one, that's the Abdul Wahid group. And they remained on the outside, and Mini Manawi is now, I don't know, something like vice president or something. But maybe he's returned to the field. There's recent developments with Mini Manawi. I'm not sure. But the word Arab, almost no one in Sudan is purely Arab. There is, I think, a small group of people in the eastern part of Sudan that can claim to be purely Arab. You see the Arab influence coming down from Egypt on the map. Egypt sits right above Sudan, and the Arab culture and influence came in. People are of mixed race, and many of the Arabs are black. The Arab, if you talk to people in Darfur, years ago they would use the word Arab as scamp, because a scamp was for them like somebody who would come in. Arabs are nomadic and semi-nomadic in the Darfur region, and they would come through, like I'm Irish, we'd call the tinkers. They would swipe your stuff, or they would have animals that would cross your land. But because of the migration routes, it was easy for the government of Sudan, Arab government, to provide, and because they had kept their ground forces weak, because they came to power by coup, very strong air force, very weak ground force. So they enlisted the help of their Arab brethren, these nomadic and semi-nomadic tribesmen. Some of them are very dark, but they would still identify as Arab because they are herdsmen, and it's tribal culture. So the people of Darfur, some 70% are non-Arab, but there are Arabs living in Darfur too, and they're Arab because their tribe defines themselves as Arab, and because they will then not be agricultural, they would sustain themselves through their animals a nomadic and semi-nomadic lifestyle. But also in Khartoum, they would define themselves as Arab because it would be culturally superior to say that. So there are many, many different definitions of Arab.
The problem with racism is that when you try to enter in the logic of racism, you become mad. What was the difference between a so-called Aryan and a Jew in the Germany of the 30s? No difference, of course. The Jews of Germany was often among the strongest and the most precious builders of the German culture. It was an invisible difference. You had to be mad as an Hitlerian ideologue to build a difference out of this question. In Rwanda, I spent some time in Rwanda and some time in Burundi. People are crazy with the story of Hutu versus Tutsi. They build big theories about the racial difference between the two. And these theories are not only big, but they are killers. It is in the name of these theories of Tutsi being a people of masters, Hutu being a people of slaves who revolt against the master, that the genocide was committed. In reality, reasonable people in Rwanda and Burundi know that there is absolutely no difference between a Tutsi and a Hutu. Again in Darfur, as Mia just said, this story of Arabs and blacks, the idea of two different races and so on, is a complete, absurd, foolish, construction of the people of Khartoum. I saw some so-called Arabs in this area of Darfur where I was, who were more black than the so-called black, and the reverse. So what we have to understand again, as always, as Sigmund Freud stated in a definitive way, is that racism is the strongest when the difference is invisible. The more the difference is little, if I dare say, the more little it is, the stronger is the madness. This is what we have to face again in Darfur. And we have absolutely not to enter in this racist logic and delirium. The difficult point, as I try to say, is that for us, Westerners who have been bred, as I said, into the idea that in order to be a racist, you had to be rich, you had to be white, and you had to be a partisan of colonization. It is very hard to imagine that this part of the world has again themselves submitted to a fierce, terrible, mad racism, but it is a fact. We have to face a racist struggle with all the obscenity, absurdity, and madness of the racism. And when we have to face that, you cannot face it with reason. You have only to face it with some sort of force. Exactly like in Bosnia. I remember I went in Belgrade and I went in Sarajevo. And the people of Belgrade said, the Muslims of Sarajevo represent another race. And so they were exactly the same. They had the same names. They had the same past. They had a shared memory. The only way to stop this killing madness was to intervene. And that's what we have to do in a way or in another in Darfur. And about the rebel groups, Mini Minawi, as Mia said, is one of the most influential men. He has been bought by the al-Bashir regime did buy him. Abdul Wahid al-Nur, the man of the rebellion, of the guerrilla, who did not accept the bargain, is not a warrior. He is not a man who likes war. He is ready to make peace. He always says it, and his position is very often misunderstood and mispresented. But he just says, I will go to the table of negotiation. I will go to the discussion of peace when, and only when, the bombing by the Antonov, the attacks by the armored lorries, stop. You stop the bloodbath first, and we discuss after. I don't discuss in the time when my people is under such a savage, racist attack. And this seems to me to be a rather reasonable position.
Thank you all very much for your participation. We're going to conclude the evening with a joint statement by Ms. Farrow and Mr. Levy, so please remain seated, and it'll be a pleasure to hear.
We wrote something out today, a sort of pledge. Given the paralysis of the international community in the face of mass atrocities ongoing in the Darfur region of Sudan for more than 5 years, given the egregious impunity of the Khartoum regime and its allies on the Security Council, which have rendered toothless all resolutions to protect the people of Darfur and to end the killing. Given the current ploy of Khartoum to place every possible obstacle in the path of an effective deployment of peacekeepers, including the perverse twisting of the words and intentions of last July's UN resolution, which stated that the UN Protection Force should be predominantly of African origin, not exclusively, as Khartoum would have it. Finally, given the fact that the African countries providing the protection battalions lack, by their own admission, the technical and logistical capacity to ensure the success of their mission to protect the defenseless civilians of Darfur.
So, in the face of all this, we today implore our governments, that is the current French and American administrations to act without delay and to partner with those African battalions needing assistance and to provide them with the essential training, the logistical support, the trucks, helicopters, defensive weapons, etc., without which their mission will only be a terrible farce. We call on respective governments to hear this appeal and take responsibility without once again hiding themselves behind the mysteries and bureaucratic inertia of the UN. This might be the last chance to put an end to the bloodshed in Darfur. This is a concrete proposal addressed to our two governments and to whoever wants to join.
Thank you.